This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing nearly $9 billion in municipal bond assets. Details at putnam.com. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Well, we made it through another day. The Fed weighed in. Nobody went bankrupt. Might not sound like much, I know, but given the alternative, not so bad, huh? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constellation Energy, global provider of fuels, power, and energy services. Committed to sound, efficient, sustainable energy solutions. Constellation.com. And by Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build stronger customer relationships through email marketing. ConstantContact.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you with us today, everybody. It's Tuesday, the 16th of September. And I'm going to oversimplify here just to make a point. How bad can things really be if Ben Bernanke's not worried? Yes, there is still a load of dislocation on Wall Street, and we'll get to that with Amy Scott in just a minute. But the Federal Reserve has kind of stumped the experts. After all that's been happening, the safe money was on an interest rate cut at the Fed meeting today. You know, just to make everybody feel better about things. Didn't happen, though. Marketplace's John Dimsdale has been following the Fed. Hiya, John.
Whew. Hello, Kai.
So not the rate cut that everybody was expecting, but there was this statement, right? What did the Fed say?
Well, it's interesting. They made only a passing reference to strains in financial markets, which is a pretty mild description about what's been happening the last week or so, if you ask me. The statement used several sentences to talk more generally about a soft economy, housing problems, fewer jobs. But then the Fed members brought up the risks of inflation, saying it's still significant. And they concluded that already low interest rates, which have been in place since the housing slowdown began a year ago or so, will eventually lead to moderate growth. So they voted unanimously to stay the course.
I don't want to second guess the most powerful central banker on the planet, but weren't there inflation numbers out today that said pretty much the opposite?
There were. We learned that consumer prices dropped just a bit, but the first time in almost 2 years. And that gave room for the Fed, given especially the big drops in oil prices, commodity prices coming down, to lower interest rates a little bit. But, you know, Fed members are also thinking that they may have to save some of their dwindling reserves because, as their statement says, interest rates are already very low. They're 2%. They don't have a whole lot more to cut. And their statement concludes that we'll monitor developments carefully and act as needed. And some interpret that to mean that the Fed could step in and adjust rates before the next meeting in October if conditions get worse.
Well, let me ask you a sensibility question then, John. Do you get the feeling that maybe they're keeping their powder dry? Should they have to do something more on Wall Street and save, frankly, the whole economy instead of just a couple of banks?
Well, I think so. You know, they're officially required to fight inflation and promote economic growth. And this bank situation is all new territory for regulators and for companies. And the risks of a spiraling failure of banks have clearly increased. And there's incredible pressure on the government, regulators, to step in, especially this close to an election day when politicians are to be held accountable. So it's really become a very delicate balancing act for the regulators, weighing the risks of taxpayers' money versus the risks to jobs in the economy. So they're looking more broadly than just the bank problems, I think.
Speaking of those bank problems, though, I wanted to bring you around to the liquidity crisis, the credit squeeze. The Fed has in the past, I don't know what, 36 hours pumped in about $100 billion, $120 billion worth of extra funding into the banking system to get it loosened up again. Why isn't any of this seeming to work?
Well, yeah, they've been very indulgent with all these banks that are stuck with bad loans. But even with all this extra cash, loan defaults so far are just sopping up all of the money that's out there. And there's still this credit crisis. And of course, the Fed is constrained by putting taxpayers' money at risk. They have to make sure that these companies will pay back these short-term loans.
Marketplace's John Dimsdale in Washington, D.C. More to come, I'm sure. Thank you, John.
Thanks, Kai.
Now back to that dislocation I was talking about a moment ago. We've got lots of it, starting with employees at Lehman Brothers. While a bunch of them are going to lose their jobs, about 9,000 will soon be employed by Barclays. The British bank agreed to buy part of Lehman's trading operations today. As for some of the other troubled names you've been hearing about, I'm afraid it's a bit of deja vu all over again. Shares in the insurance conglomerate AIG took another dive on the stock market today. Investors are questioning whether the firm's going to live to see another day. I should add here, by the way, that there are rumors, only rumors, that the Fed is working on some kind of loan package in meetings in New York. And even Wall Street's golden child isn't immune. Today, mighty Goldman Sachs reported its biggest drop in quarterly profits since it went public. Marketplace's Amy Scott has our roundup.
Let's start with AIG. The three major credit rating agencies downgraded the insurer late yesterday. That's made it more expensive for AIG to operate and to borrow. News reports today say the Federal Reserve is considering making a loan to the company. AIG is so large and has dealings with so many financial institutions, a collapse could cascade throughout the system. Hugh Johnson is chief economist with Johnson Illington Advisors.
AIG is an extremely important financial company, and everybody's watching this to make sure, hoping, crossing their fingers, that this one will not be forced to fail.
AIG has lost billions of dollars on investments linked to the mortgage market. Investment bank Goldman Sachs shed a lot of the toxic assets that burned companies like AIG. Along with Morgan Stanley, Goldman is one of the last big independent brokerage firms standing. But today, Goldman said its third quarter profits fell by more than 70%. Analyst Greg Larkin with Innovest points out Goldman is still profitable.
Having said that, I think there could be a sentiment on the street that being an independent investment bank is not possible anymore. It shouldn't be possible anymore. And that fear, that emotion, may be enough.
Enough to drive Goldman's stock to its lowest level in 2 years. Morgan Stanley also reported a drop in income today. After Merrill Lynch's shotgun wedding with Bank of America, analysts are watching to see if Morgan and Goldman will form alliances of their own. Rob Hegarty follows the securities industry at research firm Tower Group. He says more mergers are likely.
They're both very strong institutions with a good capital base. Don't be surprised to see either one or both of those firms actually do the acquiring.
Hegarty says Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley could look beyond the investment banking business for partners. One possible target, he says, Wells Fargo. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
The headlines are coming from Wall Street, but arguably this story is going to play out far from there, out where the rest of us live and work. We went to Cleveland and Philadelphia today and asked passersby how they're feeling.
What worries me the most is the population panicking. I think people have to learn to start saving money again. I think it means a lot of personal self-sacrifice and people to look inside themselves.
I really don't know what got us here. I don't know how we're going to get out of it. And I don't know how the new presidency is going to work it.
I feel for everybody else, too, you know. It's a tough world to live in right now, and I don't know how they're going to get out of it, to tell you the truth.
That was Tom Stanton and Margaret Rubel in Cleveland, Ohio, and Rick DiPietro in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Their worries are understandable. We're hearing everything from this is all going to lead to a horrible recession to perhaps the second coming of the Great Depression. There are others who say, yeah, this too shall pass. But try telling that to people worried not about their investments, but about their livelihoods. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman has that story.
There's no doubt that regular people are affected to a certain extent by what happens to the Dow and the Nasdaq. But Kimberly Clausing, an economics professor at Reed College, says in many ways Wall Street operates in a zone separate from the rest of the economy.
If stocks go down now, it's not clear that that's automatically going to be a problem on Main Street.
Clausing says there can be ripple effects when people start to worry about all that bad news from Wall Street. Consumer and business confidence can tank. Right now, the folks on Main Street are just staring at the wreckage and wondering what it's going to look like when the dust settles.
perhaps their bank or their insurance company is going under, and that might cause them to feel uncertain about the future and clamp down on their spending.
That could cripple the economy, but John Mitchell, former chief economist at U.S. Bank, says for now the economy is still strong.
We tend to always to underestimate the resilience of the U.S. economy. Some of us can remember 1987, for example, where you had percentage-wise, you know, a much more significant stock price decline, and we sort of just blew on through it. A few months later, it was like nothing happened.
Mitchell points out that broad areas of the economy are still cooking along. Exports are up, commodity prices, including oil, are down. Still, Mitchell does not think this is a few-month hiccup. There are fundamental problems in housing and credit. The market hasn't solved these problems, and it's not clear that government intervention will turn things around. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Somebody asked me last night what I thought the markets were going to do today. I said, I don't know, the Dow's going to be up maybe 120. Turns out, I was 20 points shy. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. If you picked up a paper this morning, or if you read the news online, chances are pretty good you saw a picture of the man at the epicenter of all the financial turmoil, the not-so-smiling face of Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson. As Washington power players go, Paulson enjoys a rare advantage. Lawmakers from both parties generally respect his expertise. That, though, brings me to the guy you didn't see on the front pages this morning. Both of the men who want President Bush's job have been all over the news telling us what they'd do to fix things. But don't you kind of wonder, just 49 days before the election, what difference a president can really make in economic times like these? Here's Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson.
President Bush has made one public statement in the past 48 hours about the crisis on Wall Street.
In the long run, I'm confident that our capital markets are flexible and resilient and can deal with these adjustments.
But in the middle of an economic crisis, says presidential historian Robert Dalek, there's little a president can do. What a president with credibility can do, he says, is lift the country's mood.
Franklin Roosevelt gave the first of his fireside chats about the banking crisis.
Confidence and courage are the essentials of success in carrying out our plan.
He didn't have anything all that substantive to offer as to how to turn the banks around, but overnight, people rushed to put money back in the banks as opposed to taking it out.
Dalek points out that President Bush's extremely low approval rating makes it difficult for him to have the same impact. Doug Elmendorf at the Brookings Institution says it's not what a president does during an economic crisis that matters. It's his economic policies laid out from the start.
We can't expect presidents to be experts at every intricate financial transaction, but we can expect them to understand the financial system and economics well enough to lay out clear principles that their appointees can follow.
As for the next president, Elmendorf says looking at what candidates McCain and Obama have said in the last year forms a far more accurate picture of their economic philosophies than anything they've said in the last 2 days. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
I'm not sure this is going to make you feel any better right about now, but we're not in this alone, you know. Economies all over the planet are slowing right along with us. For a long time, there was a theory that the rest of the world would be able to keep on growing even if the U.S. couldn't. Decoupling, it was called. But a year and some odd months of subprime fallout later, it looks like that theory doesn't really hold much water anymore. Robert Dunn's a professor of economics at George Washington University. Professor Dunn, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
We called you, sir, to take a little whip around the world economy and see if this decoupling theory really holds in light of what's been going on. I'd like you to go first to Russia with us. Markets down there overnight, 10 or 12%, in part, I imagine, because of oil. But what about the larger economy there and whether or not it's going to sustain?
Well, oil is their economy. There isn't a whole lot else. So if oil prices really tank, then the Russians are going to feel it. But I think the Russians have large enough cash reserves that they're not going to suffer.
Are they going to thrive?
No, but they're not going to have to cut their standards of living much. I don't worry about them. The people you worry about are Nigeria, Gabon, poor countries where they have not piled up reserves, and therefore, if oil goes down, they're going to have to reduce consumption.
And that's maybe the crux of the decoupling argument, right? That developing countries would, in theory, still be able to thrive, even if the United States and Europe had some problems.
But only if they've piled up money in the good times. But a lot of these guys have been spending the money as fast as it has come in. So if oil revenues go to the dogs, there's going to be a real shortage of foreign exchange to buy stuff they want.
What about the Europeans, Professor? How are they doing in regard to our economy and our mutual interdependence?
Well, they depend on export revenues from this country. If this economy slows down, that's going to spread our recession to some degree to them. But I think a bigger issue for them is they've got some banks and other financial institutions that are up to their ears in this subprime debt, and they're going to hurt.
We have to talk about the Chinese when you talk about the world economy. They've had a strong rate of growth, really strong, in fact, but a little bit of hiccups lately. What's going on with them?
Well, the first question is, how exposed are they to very doubtful U.S. paper? The U.S. investment bankers and their friends got a lot of foreigners suckered into this subprime game. Now, I just don't know how much they got the Chinese into that game.
Sort of sounds like you're saying, at least with the Europeans and the Chinese, that the whole global slowdown is our fault because of subprimes.
Well, I think it is the primary cause, although recessions happen anyway. But we made some terrible mistakes in the way we regulate. If I thought we'd hit bottom, then I'd say this isn't going to be too bad. The problem is I do not believe that to be true. These housing prices have a ways to go down yet.
And so, by extension, the entire global economy sits on the shoulders of the American housing market.
Well, it's certainly going to be affected by it. If our economy does go into a recession, as I think it will, and these chickens come home to roost, not just for us, but for other people who got pulled into this game by slick financial salesmen.
Robert Dunn is a professor of economics at the George Washington University in Washington, D.C. Professor, thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you very much. It's fun being here.
Coming up, customer service for the web savvy.
Any of these other companies who are doing things online and talking to bloggers or reaching out to them, they know exactly what they're doing because it's a marketing thing.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials added 141 points today, gaining 1.3% to close at 11,059. The Nasdaq rose 1.25%, 27 points, finished at 2207. The S&P 500 ticked up 20 points, that's 1.75%, finished at 1213. Shares in AIG, as you probably know by now, that's insurance giant American International Group, lost another 21% today. But that was a lot better than where it started. And anticipation that the Fed may rescue the company sent other stocks skyward. J.P. Morgan Chase deposited more than 10%. Merrill Lynch charged up 30%. Its new owner, Bank of America, packed on more than 11% today. And woohoo, WAMU, Washington Mutual. I never really understood that ad slogan. Anyway, WAMU ran up a 16% increase. Goldman Sachs, though, down 1.8%. Lower oil prices put some lift back in airline stocks. Continental jumped almost 13%. Delta soared more than 23%. Today, bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 3.48%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term financial goals. 888-VANGUARD. By Cleveland Clinic, working to redefine healthcare and the patient experience with the new Miller Family Pavilion and Glickman Tower. More at meetthebuildings.com. By the American Public Transportation Association, committed to helping Americans save on gas and become energy independent at publictransportation.org.
Marketplace aims to be insightful and provocative. And if you send our stories along, you can be too. Log on to our website and forward any story you hear. Every day's rundown is there, along with transcripts of the show and links to individual pieces. It's at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. The Commerce Department reports on new home construction for August. The Generic Pharmaceutical Association convenes its annual policy conference in Washington. And how tall is the tallest living man? How long are the longest rabbit ears? Who is able to balance the most spoons on his face? The next edition of the Guinness World Records is released. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. This might have escaped your notice amid all the turmoil on Wall Street, but up on the east side of Manhattan today, the UN General Assembly convened its annual session. There will be a slew of speeches by a series of world leaders over the next couple of days. And then the bickering's going to start. Commentator Amity Schles says the explanation for who's friendly with the U.S. at the United Nations and who's not is often economic.
Wealth is good, especially for developing nations. That used to be Econ 101. Discovering oil or diamonds moved a country forward. Those resources made a nation richer and its diplomats friendlier. Only Marxists believed otherwise. But maybe the Marxists are right. At least that's what we found at the Council on Foreign Relations. We ranked 120 or so countries by their oil wealth. Then we rated the countries by how often they voted with America on key issues in the UN. We found that the oilier a country, the less friendly it was to the U.S. Think Venezuela, Algeria, Russia. Try a thought experiment. Back in 1990, when the Cold War ended, Russia and India stood about equal chances of becoming U.S. allies. India had its tradition of feisty independence. Russia was turning westward. Then the price of oil rose and the Kremlin backed away from the U.S. and the rest. Over time, Moscow tangled with Ukraine, and now the Russians are in this ugly conflict with Georgia. India, by contrast, had no oil, nor diamonds like South Africa, nor copper like Chile. India became friendlier. The good news along the East River this week is that a U.S.-India nuclear deal seems to be moving forward. Russia seems to be a country that's creating geopolitical shocks. India seems to be a country that's absorbing them. Where's the disconnect? It's the nature of commodity wealth. When there's a windfall, be it oil or diamonds, everyone in the country starts to fight over it. You get tragic, creepy situations like Sierra Leone. That's the country in the movie Blood Diamond. When there's no windfall, people have to start finding opportunities. They have to turn to intellectual capital. We found that resource-poor countries tend to be hospitable to small business. So wealth can be a curse, at least sometimes. And if Vladimir Putin suddenly starts looking like Hugo Chavez, don't be surprised. It's not the geography or the culture. It's the oil.
Amity Schles is a columnist for Bloomberg. She's also a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. Her most recent book is called The Forgotten Man. Whatever you do, don't forget about us. Go to marketplace.org. Click on the link that says contact. If you're just catching up with social networking, here's a quick primer for you. You've got your professional network, sites like LinkedIn. You've got your social sites, that'd be Facebook and MySpace. And then if you're really hardcore about this, you're a Twitterer. That's derived from the name of the site, Twitter. It's not a big moneymaker. At last count, it had less than 500,000 active users. Facebook, just by way of comparison, has 100 million. Even though they're small in number, though, Twitterers are a powerful group, and companies looking to make quick contact with customers have taken notice, as Jennifer Collins reports.
For many of us, this is the sound of customer service.
Your approximate wait time is 7 minutes.
For CeCe Chapman, customer service took on more of a cyber tone. A couple of months ago, Chapman bought a 52-inch Samsung TV, turned it on, and
first it was letterboxed, and then on the second it had like these weird white lines on the border on the edges.
Chapman was trying to watch a Celtics playoffs game. He's from Boston, nothing stands between him and the home team. But instead of dialing up his cable company and sitting on hold until the second half, Chapman logged on to the social networking site Twitter and sent out this message.
Man, my new HDTV isn't looking so great with Comcast. I'm not sure what's wrong.
Twitter works like a large-scale instant messaging network. You can post as often as you want, but each post, it's called a tweet, is limited to 140 characters. Chapman's tweet went out to 5,000 of his friends on the site. Little did he know, his cable company also saw his SOS.
Within literally under 5 minutes, Comcast sent me a reply on Twitter and said, "Hey, Cece, what's your problem? Maybe I can help you."
Comcast sent a serviceman to Chapman's house. Less than 24 hours later, problem solved. The cable giant is one of several companies that get alerts when their names pop up on Twitter. JetBlue, Zappos, and H&R Block all have representatives on the website. Even some chief executives have been known to tweet. Howard Rheingold teaches virtual communities at Stanford University. He says more companies should use sites like Twitter to improve their customer relations.
If you're interested in real customer service, I couldn't think of a better way than having someone give you an instant answer.
Of course, most companies have help pages on their own websites, but customers say Twitter is a lot faster. And Twitter's design makes it easy for companies to address their customers' problems in real time. And then there's the publicity factor. Twitterers tend to be pretty vocal. Cece Chapman shared Comcast's good deed with all of his friends on Twitter. And he knows how that can pay off. Chapman works in marketing.
Any of these other companies who are doing things online and talking to bloggers or reaching out to them, they know exactly what they're doing because it's a marketing thing. I mean, they want them to blog and podcast and mention it.
And some companies hope that good publicity counters bad. Remember that Comcast repair guy who fell asleep in a customer's living room while on hold with his own company? He ended up on YouTube and galvanized legions of angry customers who launched ComcastMustDie.com. Well, the cable giant heard them. The website recently declared Comcast tone deaf no more. Frank Eliason can take at least some of the credit for that. He's the Comcast rep on Twitter.
You know, my biggest goal is to turn any customer around. So if someone wants to say something negative about the company,
in front of 5,000 of their closest friends,
I do want to help them.
And Eliason appears to be gaining fans, or at least curious onlookers. He has more than 3,000 followers on Twitter. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Cargill. Collaborate, create, succeed. This is how Cargill works with customers. Stories online at CargillCreates.com. And by Putnam Investments, where a 529 plan can help meet your college savings goals. Details at Putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final thought today from the Marketplace desk of what goes around comes around. Lehman Brothers, as you know, is in bankruptcy. The insurance company AIG is on the ropes. But karma has brought the two together in London. Lehman's London landlord said today the rent payments from its biggest tenants are insured by, wait for it, wait for it. Yeah, here it is, AIG. The landlord, a company called Songbird Estates, got 15% of its total revenue from Lehman last year, around $71 million for 1 million square feet of soon-to-be unnecessary office space. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow picked up 141 points, 1.3%. The NASDAQ rose 27 points, 1.25%. The S&P 500 gained 20 points. That's 1.75%. Thanks to Jennifer Collins and Doug Krisner on our morning report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by John Buckley. Coming up next time on this program, we continue our coverage of the shakedown on Wall Street. Takeovers, failure, and fear. But when, oh when, are we going to hit bottom? I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too.
Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.